We are in our final Leviticus class, and I just want to thank you guys for wanting to study some books that maybe hadn't been studied for a while, at least in the depth that we were studying it. It's been a joy for me to be in these classes with you guys. And I said before that I'm going to continue doing this kind of thing in Bowling Green, and I think the classes will be posted online if you guys want to listen. I'll be doing Deuteronomy there next. I appreciate the comments again that everybody's been making. I've learned a lot from the comments, especially from these classes. I like the more loose atmosphere where we can just kind of ask questions and make comments and stuff. So that's been a blessing. So as we finish the book of Leviticus, we've seen this chart many times. This is the 13th time now, actually, 13 classes into this. And remember that the first 17 chapters of Leviticus show you how to approach God. And would the original audience have been excited about those instructions?
Well, we hope so, because Psalm 100.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think probably.
Yeah, I would think so. Like, because the context is God has entered the tabernacle, and how does Exodus end? They can't enter the tabernacle because God's glory is in it. So would they want to know how they could have access to God's glory? That's what the first 17 chapters of Leviticus is showing. And then, so the original audience, I think, would have been excited to get all these instructions. How is it that we can draw near to Him? So when people joke today about Leviticus being a boring book, I hope that at least it's a little bit more exciting than it was before to you guys. It is to me anyways. But then chapters 18 through 17... is how you walk with God now that you've been reconciled to Him. And so we're finishing this section about holy living as we finish the book of Leviticus today. A couple introductory things about the specific section we're in. There's a chiasm in chapters 25 through 27. Does anybody know what a chiasm is, by the way? Yeah, it's like an A, B, C, C, B, A kind of pattern where you get like an A, B, C, and then it flips it and reverses it. I heard a story recently about a guy that was going through a training program in Kentucky, actually. And his final class in the auditorium, they were doing some text where he pointed out there was a chiasm. And at the end of class, some guy raised his hand and he said, "What in the world is a chiasm?" And then the bell rang and that was it for the guy's training program. So, all right, here's the chiasm in this section. Chapter 25 are laws about redemption, remember, relating to the year of Jubilee and the Sabbath years. And then chapter 26 are the blessings and the curses for the covenant. And then you get back to 27, and there's more laws about redemption. You get that kind of thing finishing out the book. I'll say more about that in just a moment. But the book, therefore, does not end with curses. And some people have wondered, why is chapter 27 tacked on there when it kind of fits more with chapter 25? It seems like an appendix, and that's maybe one of the reasons for that. I want to say just a couple brief overview things about chapter 26 and about chapter 27 before we start reading the text. I want to, the importance of Leviticus 26. Now, before I start putting anything else up on the PowerPoint here, when you guys think Leviticus 26, what else comes to your mind, if anything? Yeah, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim in Deuteronomy 27 to read the blessings and the curses. What else comes to your mind when you think of Leviticus 26? Because this is one of the most important chapters for the rest of the Old Testament.
I think it's a reminder that God's promises are going to be fulfilled, even if they're not the wonderful promises that we like.
Yes. Yeah, good. These promises here are brought up again in Deuteronomy. And like throughout the whole Old Testament, these promises of blessings and curses are going to be depicted like in every book of the Bible. So like, for example, 1 and 2 Kings depicts the blessings and the curses. When they obey, they have peace in the land under Solomon. There's a lot of good things happening in that time period. God's dwelling with them. But then there's also the curses that we're going to read about. like being defeated by enemies and being starved to the point where you're going to be eating your children even, things like this. So Leviticus 26 predicted all of these things to happen. And if you go read like any of the prophets and you talk about any, you read any of the curses that they say are going to come upon the people, it was predicted first in Leviticus 26 or in Deuteronomy 28 to 30. So really important chapter in that way. And then one thing about Leviticus 27 before we start looking at these chapters. Leviticus begins and ends with free will offerings. The first three chapters, anybody remember the first three kinds of offerings? The first one is a burnt offering. Anybody remember what the Hebrew word for burnt is? Olah, where we get the word holocaust. That's a burning is what that means. The second one was the grain offering. And then the third one was the peace offering. So those are free will offerings. Chapter 27, the book is going to end with some words about more free will offerings that we'll get to in just a moment. So in the context of these laws that are being given, would the people ever want to go beyond what God ever said? Yeah, the book begins and ends that way, but it's maybe not something that you'd expect to find in a book like Leviticus. Okay, so the outline of what we're looking at today, chapter 26, are the conditions of the covenant. If they obey this, if they disobey, then that. And then chapter 27 are the conditions of vows or voluntary offerings. Any comments or questions before we get started here? Is it too warm in here, or is it good? No? Okay, we're good. All right, let's get into chapter 26 then. And I'll start out by reading verses 1 and 2. This gives us like a summary in some ways of what God expects of the people. And everything in this chapter flows from these first two verses. You shall not make idols for yourselves or erect an image or pillar, and you shall not set up a figured stone in your land or bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Okay. I think what you're seeing here are the most basic commands for the covenant. You've got commands to not worship any idols, and then you've got commands to proactively revere the sanctuary. So you've got a sin of commission and a sin of omission here. When it says don't commit idolatry, I think this is the most, out of all the verses in the Bible, this one verse, these two verses, are the ones that describe idolatry in the most amount of ways. Is it just in verse 1? Yeah, it's all in verse 1. That the idols are described as, number 1, idols, images, pillars, or figured stones. Don't do any of those things. So you got a bunch of descriptions of them there. So that's the sin of commission. Now the sin of omission is you don't omit the Sabbaths and don't omit reference to the sanctuary. Does anybody know later on in this chapter when they get exiled, what's going to happen to the land once the people are exiled from the land? The land will enjoy its Sabbaths, right? So when it says to keep the Sabbaths, I don't think it's just saying the Sabbath day every week, but we've seen that in chapter 25 there's the Sabbath year, there's the year of Jubilee, that all of these things relating to Sabbath and rest, that you make sure that you do those things. Those are the two basic commands that he's giving here. And what he's going to do for the rest of this chapter is describe the consequences of obedience or disobedience, I think primarily to these commands. At least as these commands kind of represent all the other commands. Any comments or questions on that? All right. So when you look at verses 3 through 13... these are the blessings if they obey. The word if is found 12 times in this chapter. The condition of being blessed or cursed has everything to do with your choice to obey God. And is that true today too? Yeah, I think so. It doesn't mean that we're earning our salvation or anything of that sort, but we are called to obey God, and if we do, then God will reward those who diligently seek Him in Hebrews 11. So what he does here is there's going to be four different blessings that are brought up. The first one is they're going to have an abundance of crops. Look at chapter 26, verses 4 and 5. 3 through 5, actually. If you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last to the time of the great harvest, and the great harvest shall last to the time of sowing, and you shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land securely. And he's going to have more about security in just a moment. But what is it in the ancient world, the other religions, the pagan nations, who would they credit their crops to? Their gods. And what was the god of the storm, the rain god in the Promised Land? Baal. Do you guys remember what story is it in the Bible in 1 Kings where there's a prophet that challenges who can bring the rain? Yeah, Mount Carmel with Elijah. And so it's proven pretty definitively there that God is the one that brings the rain. But have you guys know this passage here in Deuteronomy 11? When God is about to bring them into the Promised Land, and he says that this land is not going to be like what you were used to in Egypt. How did Egypt have its crops grow? With the Nile River, which was like a consistent thing. So when you go into the Promised Land, what do you have to rely on? The rain coming down. Yeah, God's rain coming down, not Baal's rain or anything like that. So they had to. It was more obvious that they had to rely on something beyond what they already had in their nation, like with the river, for example. And so God is the source of that. And do you notice in verse 5 that they're going to be given such abundance of rain that they're always going to be working? Like, how does it say it in verse 5? Your threshing shall last to the time of the grape harvest. You're going to have so much to thresh that by the time the grapes are coming, you're going to have to get the grapes. And the grape harvest shall last to the time of sowing. So God is going to give you everything that you need if you just do what he says. Now, we'll give some applications to this in just a moment. But verses 6 through 8 show that there's going to be peace in the land. There's going to be peace from enemies, from wild beasts. And if they do have enemies, they're going to destroy them even though they're severely outnumbered. Like, look at verse 8. 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall chase 10,000, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. That should make you think of something like Gideon's 300 men. How many people did they kill or destroy it or defend against at least? 135,000. So, there's times where God's people are outnumbered, but they have peace in the land because of these people that fight these battles. Verses 9 and 10, look at these ones on fruitfulness. I will turn to you and make you fruitful and multiply you and will confirm my covenant with you. You shall eat old store long kept, and you shall clear out the old to make way for the new. What verse, does this remind you of any other passage in the writings of Moses about being fruitful and multiplying? Yeah, Genesis chapter 1. So it's like the nation of Israel is going to have what God commanded for mankind. Yeah.
And if Noah was actually struck three times.
Yeah. Yeah. So you got it in Genesis 1:28, Genesis 9:1, Genesis 9:7, I think it is. And one of the problems with the Tower of Babel is the projector is overheating. Make sure nothing is blocking the air. All right. Well, hopefully it doesn't over. What was that?
It just does that.
It just does that. Okay. Have you guys noticed the parallels before between the Promised Land and the Garden of Eden? Have we talked about those at all? Yeah, good. It land flowing with milk and honey, this beautiful kind of place. What other similarities can you think of between the Promised Land as it was supposed to be if they obeyed and the Garden of Eden?
Security.
Yeah, you got security. Like all these different blessings that are already here, the crops that they were going to have, that they were going to eat. The Promised Land is like a recapitulation of the Garden of Eden. And that shows like one of the Bible themes. Like you guys have seen before, I did a sermon on this like, I guess 2.5 years ago, so you probably all remember this. The connections between the Garden of Eden and the Tabernacle, that there's all these parallels between the two, and what God originally wanted in the Garden of Eden, he puts it in a microcosmic way in the Tabernacle, which gets put in the Promised Land, which eventually gets destroyed, so it's like Eden being lost again, mankind sinning again. And then there's these promises of God restoring everything, which eventually happens in Jesus. So some of these promises should make you think about the Garden of Eden. Look at the fourth one. Is God's presence. All of these sound like Garden of Eden kind of things. In verses 11 through 13, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. And I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their slaves. And I have broken the bars of your yoke and make you walk erect. The climactic blessing here is that God's going to be with them. And this is why he has them build the tabernacle. By the way, this passage in 2 Corinthians 6:16, Paul brings this up in the context of, what is the famous thing that people say about unequally yoked? In that context, he brings up this passage to show that God wants to dwell amongst you, Christians, and so we don't take what God is dwelling in and attach it to something that it shouldn't be attached to. And so so those are the blessings that will happen to them if they obey God. Now, any comments or questions on those things? Yeah, Terry? Yeah.
Because if you had a full crop, it'd be real tempting to go out and be working on the crop during the Sabbath to make sure it, you know.
That's a good point. I gotta write that down. Any other things that you guys see?
Just kind of jump out of this that you brought up Eden and the next of the place where it says he would walk.
Yeah.
And God came to
walk. Yeah, he was walking in the cool of the day. So you see all these connections. Like, all these promises sound like Garden of Eden kind of things. Good. Anything else you guys see here? I want to bring up something about the peace in the land. Have you guys ever noticed what does the land promise represent? So I think it represents this Garden of Eden kind of stuff. Have you guys ever noticed whenever there's a couple things to say about this. Genesis chapter 12, when God promises to Abraham that he's going to have a land. Have you guys ever heard people like show where these three promises to Abraham get fulfilled? Like, there's the land promise fulfilled in the book of Joshua, and then there's the seed promise fulfilled in the book of whatever it would be, and then I didn't grow up learning these things, so I get it. However people characterize it, I don't remember at all. But did the land promise get fulfilled in Joshua? The end of Joshua says it was fulfilled, right? That God gave him everything? Okay, The great nation promise, was that fulfilled in the Old Testament? Yeah, but were they fulfilled in their fullest? Is that even true with the land promise, though? I don't think so. Because have you ever noticed in the promise to David that David was going to have somebody who would reign on the throne forever and God would give him the land? And God is going to give them a place to dwell? They already had that when that promise is given to David. So what is the land symbolic of? These Garden of Eden kind of pictures that are ultimately fulfilled in Christ. Yeah, they were given a shadow fulfillment in the Old Testament. They were given the physical land, but not in its true symbolic meaning that we have in Christ. And ultimately the meek will inherit the earth and all that kind of thing. So anything else you guys want to say about these conditions of blessing? All right, then we turn to what's going to happen if they disobey. And I want to point out how these different sections begin. How many curses are there? Well, there's a lot, but they're grouped into five groupings. And I want to show you, look at verse 14. It says, it begins by saying, "But if you will not listen." Then skip down to verse 18. "And if in spite of this," look at verse 21, "then if you walk contrary to me," then verse 23, "and if by this discipline," then verse 27, "but if in spite of this." So there's five times where you see a phrase like this in this chapter, in this section, and I'm going to have them on the PowerPoint here if you've missed those, what I just did. So these groupings, each grouping has got several things that would happen to them, but there's five groupings that I think get more and more intense as they go. So, the first one, in verses 14 through 17, the first group of curses is something like panic, disease, and defeat. Look at verses 14 through 17. We're not going to read all of these. "But if you will not listen to me and will not do all these commandments, if you spurn my statutes, and if your soul abhors my rules, so that you will not do all my commandments but break my covenant, then I will do this to you. I will visit you with panic, with wasting disease, and fever that consume the eyes and make the heart ache, and shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. I will set my face against you, and you shall be struck down before your enemies. Those who hate you shall rule over you, and you shall flee when none pursues." Notice how he describes the disobedience. Spurning the statutes, abhorring the rules. If you try to walk away from what God says, you might say, "I've been enlightened. I've learned some new things." But how does God look at it? Spurning and abhorring. Can you do that in the name of enlightened thinking and in the name of being truly educated now and all that? Yeah, but this is how God ends up looking at it. So you've got those descriptions there. That should be kind of scary. The enemies are going to eat their produce, and their enemies are going to rule over them. So that's the first group of curses. Anything you guys want to say about that one? All right, the second group of curses is drought and famine. A lot of these are going to relate to their food being taken away. That's going to be a theme that gets brought up quite a bit. Have you ever thought before, by the way, if something happened to the trucking industry, how quickly we would all starve? How much we rely on those trucks every day? It's so fragile. Like, whenever I lived in Nashville anyways, and it would get more ice than it does here, if there was the threat of ice, people would raid the grocery stores and everything would be gone. It's a pretty fragile thing that we have. So the second set of curses, drought and famine, I want you to notice in verse 18, "And if in spite of this you will not listen to me, then I will discipline you again sevenfold for your sin, and I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heavens like iron and your earth like bronze. And your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield its increase, and the trees of the land shall not yield their fruit." The reason that God is sending these curses on them, what's the reason in this chapter? What was that? For their disobedience. But so on their side of things, it's because they're disobeying, but what's God's side of it?
He's trying to pull them back.
He's trying to pull them back. He's letting them go through something difficult so that they'll reach rock bottom, and then he'll be able to be the one that then rescues them. And for the first of four times in this chapter, God says he's going to increase the discipline by striking sevenfold. You see it in verse 18, 21, 24, and 28, that things are going to get more and more severe if you guys don't have the pride of your power broken. One of the things that I think we learn from that phrase, the pride of your power being broken, what should suffering do to us? It should humble us. It should cause whatever we take pride in. Like, what would the nation have taken pride in that these calamities would have made them not have pride in anymore? Their own strength. Like, clearly it's not what you thought it was. God did some things. He did just wave his hand and boom, you're not as strong as you thought you were anymore. So that's the second set of curses. Anything you guys want to say about that one? The third set, wild beasts are going to come on the land and they're going to bereave their children. Can you guys think of any times where wild beasts came into the promised land and killed some kids? Elisha. In the text says that the bears mauled the kids, which could be like they scratched them up and they survived. That's debatable. But this says that there's going to be animals that bereave their children. Can you guys think of other times where there's wild animals in the promised land? Yeah.
The prophet that went to Jeroboam.
Yes, in 1 Kings 13. And there's the lion that kills him but doesn't eat him. Yep. Any other times?
Oh, yeah, Samson.
Yeah. You got Samson with taking the honey?
After the Assyrian...
Yes. After Assyria conquered Israel and they had resettled some people, the Samaritans in Samaria, here in 17, chapter 17 of 2 Kings, you've got people, animals that are in that land. Yeah.
Well, even in, I believe it's in Joshua somewhere, there's a text that indicates that God's not going to settle the land not going to leave part of it abandoned because the wild animals.
If you can find that, let me know.
Where,
all right, if you guys can telepathically help each other, then let us know what you find. does this sound like the opposite of the Garden of Eden, by the way, so far, these verses? This is the opposite. Were there wild beasts in the Garden of Eden? Well, there was the serpent that got in there, but... Yeah, but there is no enmity between animals and people. All of this sounds like the opposite. The roads are going to be deserted. People are going to be fearful to travel and trade because of the wild animals. Then the fourth grouping of curses in 23 to 26, you're going to be defeated by the enemies and there's going to be famine. So it's similar things that we've seen. Look again at verse 23. And if by this discipline you are not turned to me. You've gone through three curses, and if you're still not turning back to God, then He's going to do more. But you notice here, like, what would it take for us to finally obey God? Have you ever seen people who were so stubborn that, like, their disobedience to God kept making things worse and worse and worse, and they still wouldn't turn? It's like, I had some family members who... had some really bad health problems shortly after I became a Christian, and he had to get like emergency surgery, and then he thought he had something else that was going to kill him, and we were all worried and stuff. And every time I was praying to God, like, please help us wake him up, and it didn't. There's some people that in the midst of their suffering, if in spite of this you still don't turn to me, they're going to have food, but they're never going to be satisfied with the food that they do have in verse 26. And so you're going to notice in the fifth grouping of cursings, they're going to have no food to the point where they actually start eating their children. So this is like the worst up to this point, but it's going to get worse still. So the fifth group of cursings is just like a bunch of things about destruction and famine and exile, everything like this, that is just lumped together leading up to what the Babylonians were going to do. And again, but in spite of this, if you will not listen, God is trying to rescue them all throughout this chapter. Let me just make an application from this then. Do you think God could have stopped COVID? Yeah. Do you think that there are things we could learn from these last couple of years then?
Do you think all these variants mean that we haven't learned yet?
yeah, the variants. Yeah, I don't know. Are there things that... Have people been worried about disease and being defeated and wild beasts, even if it's a microscopic wild beast? And have people been worried about being defeated by those enemies, and have people talked about food shortages and how we're going to start eating crickets and bugs now and stuff like that? Have you seen that kind of stuff on the news? People were trying to tell us to eat the cicadas, and like cicada taco recipes were online and stuff. We didn't try any of that. But what is God trying to teach the nation of Israel when they were going through something like this? Humility. Humble yourself and come to me. I'm not saying that I know God has done these things in the last couple of years, like that He's planned it or whatever. I don't know. I know that He's allowed it. Could analogously we be learning the same kind of lessons, though? We should be. So what's going to happen here in 27 and 28 is God is going to show fury against Israel. That sounds like a pretty scary thing. There's going to be starvation, eating of children, destruction, ultimately leading to exile. And once this happens in verses 34 and 35, look at these verses. The land shall enjoy its Sabbaths as long as it lies desolate while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbath. As long as it lies desolate, it shall have rest, the rest that it did not have on your Sabbaths when you were dwelling in it. So here Moses is predicting that you guys are not going to obey the Sabbaths, and the land will finally get it. How long were they in captivity? 70 years. Like 77, the number of the Sabbath and everything. 2 Chronicles 36:21, by the way, sort of makes that connection for us, that they're going to be there for 70 years because of not keeping the Sabbaths. Okay, and then the survivors after this exile are going to be fragile and weak. They're going to be scared at the wind blowing or whatever the imagery is that's given about them. These people never really regained their power. The nation of Israel never had the power that they had, like under the time of Solomon, after their defeat, like this chapter predicts. You guys know that Leviticus predicts the whole history of the nation of Israel. Really important chapter. You guys have any comments or questions about any of that? Yeah, Jerry and then Teresa.
you can see why Josiah would have torn his robes when he read, had this read to him.
Yes.
And realized that they were in the last group pretty much if they weren't careful.
Yes, very good. Good. Yeah, I wonder if they could even track like the different curses. Like it seems like we've kind of, you know, I think we're going to be exiled soon. Teresa, were you going to say something? What is that? You said Deuteronomy?
Exodus.
Or Exodus.
I will drive them out, talking about the animals, out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you.
You wouldn't drive out their enemies too quickly because the animals would become too numerous.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Is that it, Janice?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. I just had the wrong book.
So the animals... Let's see. Exodus 23, 29 through 30. Cool. All right, very good. Any other comments or questions you guys have about these things? Yeah, Kate?
So I thought about Deuteronomy 8, when God, or Moses, is telling them, you're going to get in the land, great things are going to happen. You're going to... You know, be fruitful and multiply, and the land's going to give you all these things. Don't forget me.
Yes.
It started that simply because we read this and we think, oh, okay. And they were these horrific things, eating their children's flesh and all that. But it started because they became proud of their own accomplishments.
Yes.
And they just forgot God.
Yes. And this is,
you know, like I might read that and think, I'm not going to eat the flesh of my own children.
Right.
But I might forget.
Right. And this is what, like, Ezekiel 16 about the girl that was left on the side of the road, and God comes and he passes by her. Have you noticed, by the way, in the Old Testament when it says God passes by, does it mean he's ignoring somebody? No. So he passes by Moses when he's on Mount Sinai so he can see his glory. He passes by Elijah when he's up on Mount Sinai so Elijah can see God's glory. He passes by the girl left for dead in Ezekiel 16 to give her life. Quick side point, in Mark 6, when Jesus is walking on the water, and it says he intended to pass by them, I think it's drawing on that same imagery in the Old Testament, that he was trying to show the Israelites something about his glory as they watched him walk by in amazement. I think that's the imagery of God passing by in the Old Testament. It doesn't mean he's ignoring, it means that he's wanting to show them something. But it says in Ezekiel 16 that when the woman became beautiful and all these people that never wanted her before, now she was starting to prostitute herself with them, and they all wanted her now, that in all of her sin and her abomination, she did not remember where she came from. It's so important. Biblically speaking, you guys have probably heard me say this before, but in the Bible, what does it mean to have a good memory? Does it mean you can recite book, chapter, and verse? No. If you can do that, that's great. But you can still have a good memory, biblically speaking, by never forgetting where you came from. And the nation of Israel didn't realize this. Jerry?
And that's where Romans 1 starts.
Yes. They didn't give thanks. They didn't give honor to God. They thought they were wise.
They
yep.
chose not to keep them in their mind.
That's right. Yep. Teresa?
Did you all already say that this is kind of similar to Joshua?
In what way? Oh, yeah. Yeah, the choice is given to them. Do you want life or death? That's how Deuteronomy brings up life or death a few times. Okay. By the way, in our culture right now, what do you think people are praising right now for helping us get through a pandemic? Science! Right? It's science this, science that, but not giving the credit to God. So I don't know that our society as a whole is learning what we need to learn. But whatever. Not, I don't mean whatever in a... That didn't sound the right way. I'm just saying, I don't know what I'm trying to say. All right, so when you look at this chapter as a whole then, you see then the blessings for obedience and the curses for disobedience. Look at the contrast. If they obey agricultural blessings, if they disobey, there's going to be drought, famine, etc. If they obey, there's peace and security. Then they don't have that. You see back and forth that it's the exact opposite if they disobey God. I feel like there's a lot of lessons that we can draw from that. But in what ways today would somebody be cursed in this life if they don't obey God?
If we're ever seeking to fill that space that's in them.
Yeah, there's deep needs.
And they go from one thing to something worse. They just sink deeper and deeper.
Right.
Just look at our society.
Yeah.
I mean, from the time I was growing up till now, the drastic changes that have become so evident, not that sin didn't exist, but people now just openly want what they do that God says is evil.
Right.
And at least they used to whisper about it or be ashamed if it was a divorce in the family. Or they didn't talk about people living together without marriage if it happened. You know, just different things like that.
Sure. What about I'll never have liver problems because of alcoholism, you know? Mm-hmm. Like there's certain physical problems that I might eventually have liver problems, but it's not going to be because of that, you know, because of and when 1 Timothy talks about there's blessings and promises in this life and in the age to come for obedience to God. Yeah, that doesn't mean that our life is always going to be easy either, though. But there's certain things that will be mitigated that you'll never experience by just doing what God tells you to do. So,
we're to rejoice when we have trials and to know, too, that we're being refined to come out like gold.
Right.
So there are many things that can happen.
We have purpose in our suffering.
Yeah.
Right. Good.
I think one thing, too, that we have that like the world doesn't have is when there is something, God's people come together.
Yes.
And they encourage and support one another and comfort one another and build one another up. And that's something that the world just doesn't get, except maybe in a very limited, superficial kind of way.
Right. Yep. Actually, so this is kind of interesting. The house that we're renting in Bowling Green, there's some members at the church there that just went to the house and one of the doors was open. So they looked around and they made a video for Samantha and I to watch, like, this is where you're going to live. And when they were walking around, they were like, oh, this place needs new carpet, and the paint is really bad. So then, like, people are, like, painting our house that we're renting right now and putting new carpet in on Monday and stuff. And the owner of the house, like, I was on the phone with him. He's like, yeah, these people from your church are, like, doing a ton of stuff for you guys. You know, like, that speaks something to the world. That's really, it's such a blessing when Christians come together. That's not, like, a big trial for us. If it would have been fine. Samantha grew up in a trailer park. She would be happy with anything. Yeah, Janice?
Not to prolong away from the topic, but when my husband, in his last days, reached a point where my son lives in town and I could no longer manage to be with him constantly as he needed, my son got in touch with Marty Broadwell, who was in over at the time, and he made an announcement, and there were 20 to 25 people in this congregation that volunteered to sit for segments of hours with him so that we could have a little bit of time to get some rest, you know, or whatever. And I've told that to people from time to time, and they're always shocked.
Yep.
Where is a place like that?
Right.
So that gave me an opportunity beyond all that situation to make an expression of what Christians are like.
Right. And I think that, like, John 13, by this the world will know who my disciples are when they show love for each other. There's countless stories that, and that's the way it ought to be. That's what Jesus said it was going to be like. So, very good. Okay, this chapter ends in such a beautiful way. Look at verses 40 to 46 I'm still in Exodus. Look at Leviticus 27, starting in verse 40. But if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers in their treachery that they committed against me and also in walking contrary to me so that I walked contrary to them and brought them into the land of their enemies, and if their uncircumcised heart is humbled and they make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and I will remember my covenant with Isaac and my covenant with Abraham, and I will remember the land. But the land shall be abandoned by them and enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. And they shall make amends for their iniquity because they spurned my rules and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet for all that, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them, neither will I abhor them so as to destroy them utterly and break my covenant with them. For I am the Lord their God. But I will For their sake, remember the covenant and their forefathers, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. These are the statutes and rules and laws that the Lord made between himself and the people of Israel through Moses on Mount Sinai. All right. Did you remember all the and if they don't listen and if they still don't obey? This chapter ends with a but if thing that is totally different from all the other ones that we've seen. And so this reminds me, remember, of the prodigal son, that it says in Luke 15:17 that he came to his senses when he was eating with the pigs and everything. Here the nation of Israel has been brought into exile. We see that in verse 44. And it says, if they confess, then there's going to be all these things that God's going to do. But what is it conditioned on? What is God going to expect of them in order for these promises to happen? They have to confess. Notice that in this text, there's no elaborate ceremonies. Maybe their sacrifice is implied by making amends. But the thing that it says here is, if they confess. After all these things you've done, if you just confess, and you take your uncircumcised heart and humble it. By the way, this is the first time in the Bible that circumcision is used as a metaphor. Circumcision is not brought up many times in Leviticus. I think there's only two or three times. If they would circumcise their heart and they would humble themselves, then God is going to do all these things for them. Can you think of any time in the Old Testament where somebody made a prayer that fits with what verses 40 and 42 are talking about? Confessing their sins and the sins of their fathers.
Daniel.
In Daniel chapter 9, verses 1 through 19, Daniel has this beautiful prayer about what we have done and our fathers have done and we have done these things. And so what happens if the nation of Israel does this? What will God do? Yeah. He's going to remember the covenant and the land. It hints at a second Exodus, that they're going to be coming out of the land again. By the way, have you guys ever noticed the connections or the parallels between the first Exodus and when Cyrus sends the Israelites back to the land? Have you guys seen those things before? I know we haven't talked about these. So, the book of here you've got a prediction that there's going to be a second Exodus. Isaiah 11 brings up these promises of another Exodus, or maybe it's Isaiah 12. But there's a lot of prophecies that talk about another Exodus that's going to come, which ultimately is in Jesus, but in the shadow fulfillment, I think happens with Cyrus. What does Cyrus give the people when he sends them back to rebuild?
He gives them stuff to help them rebuild.
He gives them the material. Does that sound like anything like what happens in Exodus? What did the Egyptians give the Israelites? All the plunder. What did they use with the plunder? What did they do with it? I think where they would have had the materials to make the tabernacle. So, like, both the pagans are actually giving them the stuff to go build these things as they're on their way out. There's other parallels, but that'll do for now. One thing to say from this, mercy is always available. What's more offensive, God's mercy or his judgment?
Well, we don't like to hear his judgment, but his mercy, of course, we love.
So, like, have you guys ever heard of Jeffrey Dahmer in his conversion? And I can't tell you how many times I've told that story and then somebody goes, yeah, but I'm not sure though. I mean, I really don't know. Well, have you ever listened to his interviews before he was killed in prison, after he became a Christian? Go watch his interviews. I think it was on 60 Minutes or one of those shows. Just beautiful interview. Like, the way he owns up to his sin is phenomenal. I have no reason to think that he was trying to get attention. He was already in prison for the rest of his life. But when you start to say, well, somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer could be in heaven, but then somebody like some other person that somebody thinks is great in some false religion or whatever may not be, well, that's offensive. If in the United States, the part of God that's really offensive is his judgment. But if you go to India, you know what's offensive there is his grace. Because there's honor-shame killings there, and there's no forgiveness if you've done something to dishonor the family name and whatnot. But here you've got God, his family name has been drugged through the mud by the nation of Israel, and he says, I'll forgive you. Just confess. You haven't been doing that.
Manasseh
is a great example of this. In Second Chronicles, the only account that we have where he repents. But he's like done child sacrifices, and then he's in exile, and he repents, and he comes back, and he tries to undo his work, but nobody believes him. But that's a beautiful story of God's mercy there. I think when you look at some of these stories like Jeffrey Dahmer or anybody else in history that was like one of those really bad kind of people that could be forgiven and be in heaven, that's offensive to a lot of people. God's grace and his wrath are both offensive. This section ends by God saying, I am the Lord, for the 49th and last time in the book of Leviticus. I am the Lord is used 49 times. What's 7 times 7? 49. It's all related to those numbers. And these are the laws that God gave with Israel and not with the Gentiles. He's giving these laws to them so that in Deuteronomy chapter 4, the Israelites can obey these things and show that there's a different way of living amongst the nations. We've brought up that passage before. Okay, just a couple of reflections from this chapter. Number one, if you seek God, all you need is going to be added to you. That's like what Matthew 6 says in the Sermon on the Mount. If they obeyed God and they were concerned chiefly with God and not distracted with everything else, God was going to take care of them. Secondly, there's positive and negative promises, both of which are appropriate for being motivated to obey God. It bothers me when I hear Christians say that we shouldn't be afraid of judgment as a motivation to obey, when the Bible uses that as a motivation to obey, like, everywhere. It's not the only motivation. So we don't leave that one and say, well, the only motivation should be our love for God. Yeah, that's the highest one. We get that. But don't trash the other ones that God still uses in Scripture. Just be balanced. Just care about everything that the Bible says. All right, number three, we have to have a healthy fear of God. These curses that are given here, they're like dim pictures of hell. In fact, the exile in 2 Kings 17 is away from the presence of the Lord, away from the presence of the Lord. What's ultimately away from the presence of the Lord is hell. These things are pictures of hell. In reverse, the blessings are pictures of heaven. The crops and the fruitfulness and the blessings and everything like this. But these things, the promises of judgment and the promises of blessing, should give us a healthy fear of God. It's only God that can give us these blessings. It's nothing else. And it's only God that can ultimately send us to hell. So we fear him more than anything else. Okay, any comments or questions on this chapter? All right, we'll do chapter 27 quickly here. Just a couple things to introduce us to this chapter. The outline of what we're seeing here, the first 25 verses show you voluntary offerings, and you can voluntarily offer a person, and we'll say what that means in just a moment, animals or houses or lands. And then the chapter ends with non-voluntary offerings, things that you have to give to God that are not in the voluntary kind of category. One point to make from this is that vows are voluntary. So God is giving these instructions for them if they wanted to go beyond what was required. One passage that relates to this is Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 through 6, where it says, when you vow a vow to God and do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? This instruction in Ecclesiastes relates directly to the kinds of vows that the Israelites would be making in Leviticus 27. So you've got that, and ultimately none of these things that they could vow to God compares to what God did for them in the Old Testament. Nothing that we give to Christ or God could ever compare to what he ultimately gave to us. But we'll talk about how this works for them in just a moment. One other thing before we start reading this chapter. In Leviticus 26, God's going to keep his vows. What does he expect the Israelites to do in chapter 27? You keep your vows. So you see something like we've seen all over the Bible, that you do something because God is also doing it. And he's first done it for you. So, with that in mind, look at Leviticus 28, and we're not going to read all of this. We're probably not going to read much of this chapter. But look at 27, starting in verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to the Lord involving the valuation of persons, then the valuation of a male, and then I'm going to have a chart that shows this. But here, they're valuing people, and the people are being vowed to God. So here's my question here. When would a person be valued or vowed to God?
At birth?
Yeah, for what reason?
To serve, to help the Levites in some manner, or the priests.
Yeah, I think some kind of service to God, something like maybe like the Nazarite vow maybe has some connection to that.
Maybe even in the army fighting for him? Or
yeah, I don't know. I that's a possibility.
That's like what Hannah did with Samuel.
Yeah, 1 Samuel 1:11. You will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give your servant a son. Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. So I think this valuation of persons is like they're being dedicated to the Lord for some special thing, but it doesn't mean that they're sacrificed. That's not the idea. You could be bought out of the vow, though. So, like, if you wanted, if somebody was vowed to the Lord, you'd have to pay something to buy them out of it. And here's a chart that shows it. Now, there's, as you look at this, there's some things that might upset some people. What could be upsetting about this? 1 month to 5 years, the cost in shekels was 5 for a male, 3 for a female, and then who's worth more?
Males.
That's right. Why?
Women are not worth much.
Yeah. Okay, what's the rationale for this?
They're the fighters.
Okay, so maybe, yeah, the fighters. What could the answer not be?
They're not valuable
in the eyes. Yeah, this has nothing to do with intrinsic value. And we know that because all people are made in God's image. Male and female, God created them in his image. Also, the elderly are not worth as much. So, did Leviticus say anything? Did Leviticus say anything about honoring older people?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Leviticus 19:32, to honor the person with the gray head. This has nothing to do with intrinsic value. What does this have to do with?
Perhaps leadership and the responsibilities that go with that.
Maybe power.
Yeah, maybe the labor value in the field, something like that. Now, this is an agrarian society, like lifting things in the tabernacle. Like, I don't know what kind of service they would be doing, but this is not like... my take on it is that it has something to do with the labor values, like specifically tied to the fields, which is what they did back then. Would we all agree that a 4-year-old can't do much as a 20-year-old male in the field? Is it fair to say that a female maybe wouldn't have the same kind of physical strength in that way?
And the old people can't either.
What was that?
The
old folks can't either. So... but they could do something, you know. So I think that's kind of the picture. The Bible up to this point has said so much about the intrinsic value of everybody that it can't be anything about that. Yeah.
Well, if they were being vowed to serve in the tabernacle or serve the Levites or something, then it really does make sense that you are basically buying back someone who might have more use in the tabernacle.
Yeah.
And obviously females would not be useful in the service of the tabernacle or the... whatever.
Were there women that did serve in the tabernacle?
They did the needlework and the embroidery.
What is in 1 Samuel with Eli, his sons are sleeping with some of the women that are involved in that. But I think even Exodus brings up some women that are like, there's women that had some kind of service that they did in the tabernacle. So we're putting these pieces together.
Anna didn't depart from the temple.
Anna, right? In Luke. Yeah, didn't depart from the temple. Yeah. Were you going to say something, Janice?
That's what I was
going to say. Oh, okay, all right. Yeah. So, the text doesn't say this is when somebody would be vowed to the Lord and this is why. So we kind of have to put some pieces together, and it seems like this is the case, but I'm not exactly sure. Any other comments or questions on that part? Notice in verse 8, if someone is too poor to pay the valuation, then he shall be made to stand before the priest, and the priest shall value him. The priest shall value him according to what the vower can afford. Can you guys think of the other times in Leviticus where provisions are made for the poor where they have to pay less than those who are wealthier?
When a woman is being purified.
Yeah. After birth. Yeah, after birth. What else?
Well, and even offerings.
Yeah.
It would be doves or something.
That's right. So you got the offerings for in those situations. So in chapter 1, you got it, the purification offering in chapter 5. The mother of a new baby in chapter 12, and then also leper. It's in God's laws that if you have more, it makes sense to pay more. And if you have less, you should not be expected to pay as much. That's part of how God built his economy. And so, again, one of the things that the Bible does repeatedly is it forces us out of the strong right or the strong left mold that the world wants us to be in. It challenges both, and it affirms both in some ways. And so we're kind of part of a whole other thing. So,
in Corinthians 9 says it's acceptable to the man has, not according to he has not.
That's right. Even in the New Testament,
give as your prosper.
Yeah, give as you prosper. I remember one time I was sitting with a woman in California who was upset that she couldn't afford to give 10%. And I said, the Bible doesn't say that anywhere. And she's like, but I need money so I can give 10%. I'm like, oh, I see what you're doing.
Well, and think about the widow offering the mite and how she was praised by Jesus because she gave all that she had, which indicates that she was very poor.
Yeah, I do have a different take on the widow's mite story. I think she's actually a victim of the Pharisees. Because in Mark 12, Jesus talks about scribes and Pharisees who devour widows' houses. The next story is the widow giving everything she has. Now, is God going to take care of her? Is she doing what she's doing on faith? Yeah, she's not doing anything wrong, but has she been taken advantage of by the scribes and Pharisees who are devouring widows' houses? I think so. This is interesting in verse 8. The priest is the one that determines what the poor person can afford. So that means that I don't know if the priest is looking at the income of this person and saying, okay, well, I think you could do this. This would be reasonable. But this is the first time where it's not like a fixed amount that the priest has to set aside or what they can offer, like in the sacrificial offerings with the birds or something. The priest gets to value this. And so I like that God never prohibits any person from worshiping him. You see it repeatedly in the book of Leviticus. Really cool idea. Anything you guys want to say about the person's stuff? All right. If you wanted to vow an animal, and it was a clean animal, you can't exchange it with another. You can't change your mind after you vowed an animal to God. If you try to change it, then both of them end up going to God. And so one lesson from that is you shouldn't regret anything that we give to God. You should make your commitment and follow through with that. You can also give unclean animals to God. Well, a clean animal, you could imagine, could be sacrificed. What would you do with an unclean animal? It can't be eaten. It can't be sacrificed.
It could be involved in some kind of labor work. Right?
Yeah.
Even camels. I think there were camels in Palestine. The desert was close by.
What if you were an Israelite and you had some donkey, but you were really good friends with a priest who needed a new donkey? Could you vow it to the Lord for the Lord's, you know, priests to have a donkey or something like that?
To pull a cart.
Yeah, to pull a cart, get a new thing to drive around in or whatever. Like, people could do that sort of thing. So I would imagine that would be one of the purposes for vowing an unclean animal. The priest assesses the value. You could redeem the vow, but you had to add a 20% charge to what you had given. So those are the vows for the animals. You go to the objects, and you got houses. And in this situation, the priest functions as, like, the house appraisers. Can you guys think of some of the different roles that priests have? When you study Leviticus in depth, you see that there's a wide range of things they were supposed to do. What are some of the things that they're supposed to do?
Evaluating disease.
Yeah, they're kind of functioning like doctors with leprosy, right? What else?
Building inspectors.
They're building inspectors to see if there's mold in the house? Yeah. What else?
They're teachers.
Yeah, they're teachers.
What about mediators?
Yeah, they're mediators between God and man. Good.
And they keep everything going in the temple. I mean, it needs to be done.
Yeah, so they're cleaning things and keeping things in order.
Judging and accounting.
Yeah, like they're evaluating things. They're house appraisers. Like, they've got a lot of different things. Before studying through Leviticus for you guys, I never noticed how many different things that the priest did. I thought it was just teaching and mediation. Yeah, those are probably the most important things that they did, but these are other things that were also given to them. And so if you dedicated a house to the Lord, I'm not sure why you dedicate a house to the Lord. Is it so that these priests can live in it, but they had their Levitical towns? I don't know why you would do that, but apparently there'd be times where you'd do that. There are also lands. In verse 16, you can partition off part of your land to the Lord, so it didn't have to be all of your land. But there's two kinds of land that could be dedicated to God. It could be land that's in your family, or land that you've purchased, which is really like a lease because of Jubilee, because it goes back to the families. So you could maybe give the crops to the priest, something like that. And all of it is valued in relation to Jubilee, and so we've seen those things there. Okay, everything for these valuations and buying something back is all done with the sanctuary shekel. That's the measurement that they use for these things. One more thing here then, and then we're done with Leviticus. The chapter ends with non-voluntary offerings, things that you couldn't, like, redeem, things that you had to give to God, and they were not, like, voluntary things. So, firstborn animals, they cannot be vowed to God since they already belong to God. But if you had one that was born impure, it could be redeemed. There are things that are devoted things, things that are specially given to God. The Hebrew word is harem. Does anybody know where else that word is used, or what contexts harem or harem is used?
Jericho,
like the devoted things in war. That there's like the spoil of war goes to God first. I just have that there. Good. All right. So if devoted objects can't be sold or redeemed, they belong strictly to God. And if it's devoted persons, they have to be destroyed, like the Amalekites had to be destroyed. And then you also have tithes. These things are not voluntary. You have to give them to God. Does anybody know how many tithes the Israelites paid, it seems?
Three.
So the first tithe would be to the priests, it seems, in Numbers 18. The second one would be the tithes to the sanctuary in Deuteronomy 14. Now, it's possible that these two are talking about the same thing, that what was brought to the sanctuary would be given to the priests, but it's also possible that they're different ones. And then, every third year, there were tithes for the poor. So, if you add all that up, it's possible that the Israelites paid 23% of what they made in taxes. But there's some debate about that. When it comes to their tithes, though, they can be redeemed. Part of their tithes can be redeemed when you add 20% of the value. Let's say there's some crop that you really liked or whatever. You could add 20% to it and buy it back. But it was never a voluntary sacrifice. It was it was something that was always God's anyways. But you could buy some of it back. And then also every tenth animal was holy to the Lord. And so just things that they had to give to God. Okay, conclusion of the book. Look at verse 34. These are the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. Several times throughout the book, you see that Mount Sinai is referenced as the place where they're getting these laws four times. but we began this book by pointing out that Leviticus has more direct speech from God than any other book of the Bible. All the times that it says, the Lord spoke, and then we see what he spoke. If Leviticus was red letters, it would almost be all red letters. Like, if every time God spoke was red letters. There's a sense in which the whole Bible would be red letters, I get that. But, like, direct speech from God, as it's recorded, Leviticus would almost be all red letters. Because of, it's just Moses getting these instructions and the people needing to obey those things. So, all right. Anything anybody wants to add to any of that or comment on? Can you think of some vows that we've made that God expects us to keep?
Marriage. Well, I'm becoming a Christian.
Yeah. When you get baptized. If everybody catch that was wrong.
Well, we are, in a sense, we're devoting our life to Christ.
Yeah.
And that's where it begins.
Right. Yeah, you're signing up to follow him the rest of your life. And so God expects us to keep our words. Even like smaller seeming words, like I promise to make this payment or I promise to. God expects us to keep our words. And so that's part of the care.
Psalm 15 speaks of those who vow to their own hurt and change not.
Right. That you keep a vow even when it hurts. Like, oh, this vow is really hurting me right now. Well, yeah, you said you were going to do it. So, does God keep his word?
Yes.
He keeps his word, and we were made in his image. He's trying to make us like him. So our word should be very important. We should be careful with what we agree to do, even, because of Ecclesiastes. It's better to have not made a vow so you don't have to keep something that you said you were going to do and then break it. So
I've known of circumstances where Christians were noted, especially for their honesty, by a banker or someone else
yeah.
who said you can trust those people because they'll do what they say.
Yep, that's good. Cool. All right, well, I'm sorry we went a little over time, but this is the last time, so I appreciate you guys wanting.
You just won't come back.
I just won't come back. No more of these studies, I'm sorry. Sewell, could you pray for us?
Our Father, what a wonderful revelation we have of your holiness and your faithfulness under all circumstances. And we're thankful we have these predictions made so long ago, which we can see fulfilled in history, as you have kept their promises, both for good and for the punishment of those who are disobedient. Lord, help us to make these admonitions our own, to respect your word, to keep it as best we can, to be faithful not only in our vows to you, if we are obedient to the gospel, but also our vows even to others, so that we may be known as those who are Christ-like and godly in our day-to-day functions. And we pray, Father, for Eric as he and his family leave us to serve in other places. We're thankful for the good messages and studies that he has engaged in with us, for the information he's given and the encouragement and admonition. And we pray that you'll bless him in his new work and bless us as we continue here in our efforts to serve you and to serve our community. Keep us even through this day according to your will. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.